Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
And I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
Key U.S. allies are ignoring warnings from Washington and moving to formally recognize Palestinian statehood.
This is one step forward towards Palestinians getting and regaining control over their own borders, over their own land.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The government in Israel says Palestinian statehood will never happen. Also today, a court case in Northern Ireland takes us back to 1972 and the events of Bloody Sunday.
It was a last gasp kind of attempt by the Northern Ireland government to try and beat our community into submission.
Plus, a new global agreement aims to safeguard what happens far away from land in the world's oceans.
Honestly, there is so much that happens on the high seas that we are not aware of.
Those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. Global leaders are gathering at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in New York this week.
Top officials and diplomats from just about every corner of the globe will meet at UN headquarters in Manhattan. One issue that's at the top of the agenda is connected to the war in Gaza. Several countries announced over the weekend that they will formally recognize a state of Palestine. The United Kingdom is one of them.
We recognized the State of Israel more than 75 years ago as a homeland for the Jewish people. Today, we join over 150 countries who recognize a Palestinian state also.
That's British Prime Minister Keir Starmer making the announcement. Other U.S. allies are doing the same. The world's Shirin Jafari is at the United Nations in New York and brings us the story.
I am at the General Assembly Hall where a conference to recognize a Palestinian state is being held today. It's chaired by Saudi Arabia and France, and the goal of it is to bring together all of the countries that are formally recognizing the state of Palestine. France is another one of them. The delegations are starting to head into the hall right now.
Canada, Australia, and Portugal are the other nations that have said they recognize the state of Palestine. Some of these nations are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, and their declaration today marks a symbolic milestone for Palestinians. It comes about a week after a United Nations inquiry found that Israel has committed genocide in Gaza. Israel rejected the report as, quote, distorted and false.
This is one step forward towards Palestinians getting and regaining control over their own borders, over their own land, and also having the capacity to deem illegal the settlements in the West Bank, as well as generally overall Israel's presence in Gaza.
Shahid Hamouri teaches at the University of Kent in the UK. She has also consulted on legal cases at the International Criminal Court.
Of course, it comes with the risk that states use this to say that we have done something rather than take forward what they must do under international law. And these, I have to reiterate, are very strong international legal obligations.
Most of the world already recognizes the Palestinian state. That gives it the opportunity to have its own Olympics teams, diplomatic missions abroad, and to participate as an observer state at the United Nations. Today's announcements, Hamouri adds, comes after almost 2 years of these nations' inability to stop the destruction in Gaza.
when we look at the situation, we need to ask ourselves a very important question, which is, are they doing this with the genuine intention to do something about this, or are they doing this just so that they will look better than the very, very dark image that we are looking at today?
The Israeli military began its operation to take over Gaza City earlier this month. Thousands of people have been forced to move once again to the south. Many have been displaced multiple times. The death toll in Gaza continues to rise on a daily basis, and reports of hunger and malnourishment continue. Hamouri says countries have to take concrete steps to end the carnage in Gaza, like imposing arms embargo, economic sanctions, and diplomatic isolation. Otherwise, today's announcements won't mean much to the people on the ground in Gaza, she says. In Israel, the response has been strong. Officials there are describing the recognition as a reward to Hamas. A Palestinian state will not be established, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a video. He said for years he has prevented the establishment of this state despite enormous pressure, both from within and from outside. And as part of that effort, he says, he has doubled the settlements in the occupied West Bank. American officials have also described the vote as, quote, yet another misguided and ill-timed publicity stunt. But for Yotam Kipnis, this is a step in the right direction.
This should give us hope and a vision for a future and show us that two states living alongside are possible.
Kipnis' parents were killed during the Hamas attacks on October 7, 2023. His father's caregiver was also killed. Nine of his family members were taken hostage as well. They have since been released, he says.
Personally, you know, it was devastating.
Kipnis says instead of being vengeful, he's been investing his energy in peace building. He's part of a grassroots campaign that's circulating a petition calling for the creation of a Palestinian state.
Peace with the Palestinians is not only possible, but it is necessary. And nowhere could it be as clear as now how necessary it is.
Kipnis says the Israeli government has shown that it is not interested in ending the war or making peace with the Palestinians. The Israeli public is divided on the issue too, he adds, and that's clear every time he goes to anti-war protests.
When I go to those protests, I sometimes see people who aggressively attack and who shout at us and curse us. And I don't even want to say what they're saying about our families who have been lost.
But he continues to push forward. So far, the petition has received about 9,000 signatures. Their focus is not to change anyone's mind, Kipnis says, but to encourage those who believe in a two-state solution to be more vocal.
Not only do we need to end the war, but we also need to prevent the next war.
Experts say the current situation on the ground in Gaza and the unwillingness of the far-right politicians in Israel to compromise makes it hard to imagine the implementation of the two-state solution anytime soon. Prime Minister Netanyahu said he plans to meet with President Trump soon. The Trump administration didn't grant visas to the Palestinian representatives for the UN General Assembly. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is scheduled to address the audience on Wednesday by video. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari at the United Nations in New York.
Listen for more of Shirin's reporting from the UN all this week. Airports in Europe are still grappling with a major cyber attack over the weekend. From London to Brussels to Berlin, travel hubs have been plagued with flight delays and cancellations. The European Union's cybersecurity agency say criminals targeted the automatic check-in systems with ransomware. We asked Junaid Ali to explain what happened. He's a cyber expert at the Institution of Engineering and Technology in Edinburgh.
What a ransomware attack is it's where hackers will essentially use a specially designed piece of software which will encrypt all the files on a computer system and will only be decrypted when a ransom is paid. And sometimes even if the ransom is paid, the files won't actually be decrypted. And so that's what's being reported to have happened here. It's actually quite interesting because there was actually a report a couple of years ago, which the agency also put out, which identified of these as kind of the dominant type of attacks on transportation systems across Europe.
Mm. So how many airports were impacted? And do you know what the current status of those airports are right now?
Yes, we don't have a clear idea as to how many airports were using the system, because also one of the factors is that certain airlines will have been using systems they can fall back to. But what we tend to see is that this is a type of supply chain attack. So a supply chain attack, what that means is that when a service is being provided to someone, when something is happening in critical national infrastructure, there is the end service, but there is also this supply chain of things behind the scenes which happen. So at an airport, that is the boarding systems, that's the check-in systems. But what you tend to find is there's a consolidation in the market for the things. So there's a lot of different airlines. They'll need to buy aircraft. Who do they buy the aircraft from? It'll be either Airbus or Boeing. Similarly, when there is check-in systems, there will be a consolidation in the market. And as a result of this, what we expect to see is that there is actually a small amount of players who are offering those types of systems.
So this might have been widespread if it was targeting one particular software that was used by a lot of different airports.
Exactly. And I think this really highlights the need that, you know, yes, this provides an advantage that we can get security updates very quickly out into the real world. But the kind of disadvantage is we need to make sure these systems are resilient. So that's the big thing which is kind of underlies this, is the need for there to be resilience in these systems.
In this case, did this just impact those self check-in kiosks? So there would be other options to check in, like at the counter or online?
So this really depends, again, on the resilience that the airlines have put in. So I do understand that British Airways at Heathrow, I think they had some resilience put into their system. So there would be fallback systems. So it really depends on where this technology is applied. I think the big thing that we also don't understand at the moment is, whilst the European Union's Agency for Cybersecurity has kind of explained that this is a ransomware attack, we don't know what the initial access vector looked like. So we don't know how they initially got control of the system. But what I think is actually more likely to have happened is it would probably, from the previous data of these types of attacks, is that it would probably either be someone's login details, someone who has privileged access to the system, their details being compromised either because they have fallen for essentially a scam, a phishing email, or it's been in a data breach. So it's really important for both the people who are working in critical national infrastructure and the end users to be really up to scratch on what it means to have secure password practices in this kind of environment.
Interesting that there could be just one weak link here that could have caused all of this. Is there any sense of who is behind this?
It's a bit too premature to understand who is behind it. And of course, there are tactics that these attackers use to kind of obfuscate who they are.
And what's the current status of this attack? Are there still airports that are unable to access the software?
So again, this, I think it will be a kind of fact-specific exercise as to what that will look like from airline to airline and how they're responding, not just with the immediate outage which has happened, but also the knock-on effects to that. Certainly, I think restoring systems, that's something we expect to take from hours to days, depending on how resilient the airports are. So it really comes back to that kind of fact-specific exercise of how each airport has its contingency and resilience planning in order to determine how quickly each one can come back online effectively.
We hear about these types of attacks not infrequently at places like hospitals, airport systems. Is there any hope that at some point we may be able to put a stop to these, or are hackers always going to be one step ahead of people trying to stymie them?
Yeah, so I think attackers will often change their tactics, and I think that will happen throughout history. Increasingly, attackers are reliant on the human link. So that's where they will use these things like phishing emails, so these scam emails, to get access to people who control the systems. And I think the key thing with that at the moment is the kind of day-to-day cybersecurity all of us are responsible for. So the things around being cautious around when we get suspicious emails, even if the timing is right, having being secure passwords, enabling two-factor authentication on our logins. Those are the things that we can all do to keep ourselves safe and to keep our organization safe and ultimately protect critical national infrastructure.
Junaid Ali is a fellow at the UK-based Institution of Engineering and Technology. Cyber attacks aside, planning for a big trip can be stressful. Booking a flight and hotel, remembering all of those chargers you have to bring.
And here's one I know well, figuring out who's going to take care of the dog while I'm away. In Italy, one airport is bringing luxury to dog sitting. Dog Relay is essentially a five-star hotel for our canine companions.
It's inside the Fiumicino International Airport in Rome and has all the amenities of a nice human hotel, including a porter service that picks up your dog when you arrive at the airport.
The standard room is climate-controlled and includes access to private outdoor gardens. For added fees, your pup can enjoy grooming, aromatherapy, even a massage. More timid guests can stay in private rooms where they're kept away from other dogs.
The residents of one embattled city in Sudan are trapped inside it after one side in the civil war built a wall around them. The extremes of fighting in Sudan's civil war, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Desperate barely begins to describe the situation for more than a quarter million people in the west of Sudan. They're besieged in the city of El Fasher, where attacking rebels have built miles of earthen berms, effectively walling off the city.
That means civilians are unable to leave the city, and food, water, and medical supplies are blocked from getting in.
El Fasher is the last city in western Darfur not controlled by the Rapid Support Forces. That is the paramilitary group that's been fighting the Sudanese army since 2023. On Friday, the RSF used a drone to attack a mosque, killing 75 people during morning prayers. And this is just one of the many atrocities being inflicted on the Sudanese people.
A quick heads up here, our next report contains descriptions of the violence that they are facing. Catherine Harold is the bureau chief in Nairobi, Kenya for The Washington Post. She and her colleague Hafiz Haroon have been speaking with residents of El Fasher about what's going on there. Catherine Harold joined me earlier today to talk about the situation for Sudanese civilians in the besieged city.
It's absolutely horrifying. They essentially have to choose between staying and starving slowly, or potentially getting obliterated in a drone strike or killed when the paramilitary overruns the city, or risking trying to escape. All the roads outside are controlled by the RSF and allied militias, and they are killing people, raping people, holding people for ransom so that families have to pay to get people out. And it's absolutely terrifying for them. It's a very difficult choice to make, because you can die if you stay and you can die if you go. And you have to make the right choice for your family. And nobody knows really what that's going to be.
I mean, not a single international aid delivery has gotten into El Fasher since April. Two UN truck convoys have been bombed while trying. What are people actually finding to eat?
They are mostly surviving off of animal feed and wild weeds. The problem is, if the men go out to forage, then they are often killed immediately. And so women and children go out, but then they're often attacked and raped. So you have this terrible situation where fathers are overcome with guilt, because if they leave, they will probably be killed. But if their families go out, they will be subjected to horrific abuses. So it's really awful. We spoke to one father who was so overcome when talking about his 14-year-old daughter's rape that he had to end the call several times because he was crying so hard.
It's really horrifying. I mean, and that man, the one that you're speaking about, he only used his first name because of security reasons. That's a father whose daughter and niece went out to gather weeds to eat, right?
That's right. Like, imagine sending your teenage daughter and niece out to go and get dandelions because you're so hungry. And this is what they risk. Gang rape, it's such a stigma in the community that the 14-year-old girl didn't want to come back and face her family at all. She said she just wanted to die.
So the RSF is building this long earthen berm. How is that affecting the fight being put up by the Sudanese National Army inside El Fasher?
Well, in the last sort of week or so, We've seen substantial RSF advances. They've closed off almost every route out of the city. It's very hard to smuggle any food or medicine in there, which is what was happening before. Prices are spiking. We're seeing drone strikes very close to military positions. And we're seeing the Joint Forces headquarters was overrun last week. Yale Humanitarian Research Lab has actually put out a flash report saying this city is about to fall.
We have heard reports that some residents have escaped El Fasher over the wall at night. What happens to them?
So they then have a long and dangerous journey to either Tawila, a town that's completely overwhelmed with hundreds of thousands of people that have basically arrived with nothing. That's a very, very dangerous route. And we spoke to one man that had left the city with 60 people to try to get to Tawila, and they had been repeatedly attacked. His best friend was whipped to death in front of him. His brother was shot in the head. He prayed with him as he was dying. He himself was injured in the leg and crawled for 2 days down the road before he gave up hope. And luckily some women came by and put him on a donkey and took him in there.
So citizens in El Fasher, in fact, all across Sudan, are under siege. What are they doing, though, to kind of counter any of this violence?
Well, amid the great stories of suffering, this intense suffering, are amazing stories of heroism from the emergency response rooms, which are civilian-run volunteer groups, often run by former pro-democracy activists, that have sprung up all over Sudan. And they smuggle medicine across the front lines. They deliver food packages to people who can't leave their homes. Many of them have been arrested and tortured or killed because people accuse them of being spies. But they are truly the heroes of this war. And I wish that more people could hear about their work.
I mean, given the deprivation of all kinds of stuff in Sudan, how much do those emergency response rooms and the people running them, how much do they depend on resources coming in from outside the country?
Well, good question. They had been receiving some money from USAID in many cases. In fact, that made up 77% of their funding last year. Wow. Earlier this year, that funding stopped overnight. And when I was in Khartoum, I met many families whose children had immediately starved to death because that one meal a day was the only thing that was keeping them alive. I met one woman who had watched two children starve to death, one after the other, and just couldn't do a thing about it. 10 children in her neighborhood had starved to death within a period of weeks after that funding cut.
And Catherine, so much has been said about Sudan being the forgotten war. Attempts at peace, even ceasefires have come and gone with no success. Where you are in Nairobi, Kenya, what are the conversations you're hearing over how the dire situation in Sudan might be addressed this week at the UN General Assembly?
Sudan is the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. 12 million people have fled their homes. It threatens to destabilize, you know, the entire Sahel and Horn of Africa, which is already in great turmoil. So I hope that we will see some pressure on the actors. There was a statement earlier this month from Egypt, America, the Qataris, and Saudi Arabia calling for a ceasefire. That's resulted in nothing at all.
Catherine Harold is the East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. She's been telling us about the situation in the besieged Sudanese city of El Fasher. In Egypt today, the country's most prominent political prisoner has received a presidential pardon.
Ala Abdel Fattah has spent most of the last 12 years behind bars. He became a prominent voice for democratic change in Egypt during the Arab Spring, which began in 2011. 2 years later, a military takeover led by the current president targeted supporters of the uprising. Since then, thousands of Egyptians have been sent to prison, many without being formally charged.
The activist Abdel Fattah is a software developer. He's also a dual citizen of Egypt and Britain, and he and members of his family have gone on repeated hunger strikes over his situation. For years, world leaders have been calling for his release from prison. Today, a statement from Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said that a pardon had been granted for several prisoners, including Abdel Fattah.
The statement read, in part, this decision reflects the state's commitment to strengthening human rights initiatives, promoting tolerance, and offering those pardoned the opportunity to begin a new life.
It's not clear what's next for Ala Abdel Fattah. His family said today's news came as a surprise.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The world is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, the world has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
News about H-1B visas over the weekend got the attention of highly skilled high-tech workers from abroad. On Friday, the Trump administration announced a new $100,000 fee for those visas. The previous fee had been slightly more than $200. By Saturday, the White House was walking back the policy. That enormous fee is real, but it only applies to new visa applications, and it will be a one-time fee for foreign workers, not an annual one.
While the global tech industry continues to react to that new visa rule, the Trump administration's focus on immigration is having an impact on the healthcare industry as well. Some healthcare jobs, especially at nursing homes or as home health aides, are frequently done by immigrants with a specific kind of work permit. As those permits get revoked, it's putting a nationwide strain on workers and the healthcare sector generally. From GBH in Boston, Sarah Betancourt has the story of what this looks like in one particular state, Massachusetts.
For more than a year, Robert spent his days getting seniors dressed, taking their vital signs, and helping them eat at Edgewood Life Care Community in North Andover. But one day in May, that changed. A human resources officer said his work permit was no longer valid. He would lose his job as a certified nursing assistant.
When they said, "You won't be able to work," I cried because I had a good relationship with them. They loved me so much because I took good care of them.
Robert is one of thousands of immigrants in Massachusetts who have been laid off or are at risk of being laid off. Originally from Haiti, he was in the U.S. under a federal program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans fleeing persecution. But this year, the Trump administration ended what was known as the CHNV program and revoked the legal statuses for hundreds of thousands of people like Robert, who were already in the U.S., making them undocumented. Because of that, he's worried about deportation. GBH News agreed to use only his first name. While Robert and immigrants in similar positions are facing job losses and deportation fears, the sectors that rely on them for labor are also anxious.
We are starting to see an already nervous healthcare industry lose key staff. And they've followed all the rules. They got trained in a new profession. They went into the workforce in a workforce that needs them. And they've now lost their jobs. So it is a very unfair system.
That's Jeff Thielman, CEO of the International Institute of New England, which helps immigrants develop careers. In Massachusetts, one in four healthcare workers are immigrants, according to the Leah Zalman Center for Immigrant Health Research. The share is even higher for home health aides, whose workforce was 46% foreign-born in 2018. Jake Krylovich is executive director of Home Care Alliance of Massachusetts, a trade association working with more than 200 home care providers. He says a thinner workforce means safety risks for people who need care.
That puts people at risk from falls or complications from chronic disease, which would then make them have an event that they would have to go into a facility or an emergency room visit from a policy perspective, it strains our healthcare system, is more costly when people are admitted to the hospital.
Employers are already feeling the losses. John Sneath, the CEO of Tribute Home Care, which serves elderly clients, he says the terminations have been harmful and abrupt.
One of our caregivers got a letter saying that he was no longer eligible to work and needed to go back to Haiti. He brought the letter to our attention. We didn't, frankly, know what to do because we knew that we had others under that program.
The company then started receiving notifications from the Department of Homeland Security's E-Verify system, saying that anyone with CHNV parole was ineligible to work, with their permits no longer valid. Regina McNally, Director of People and Culture at Tribute, said 9 caregivers were let go.
People who are fabulous humans, who have this relationship with their client, which is so powerful. The folks that had to make the termination calls were literally in tears and struggling to go on with their day because this is something so out of our control.
When asked about the policy shift's impact on the healthcare workforce, the Department of Homeland Security told GBH News that the program had been massively abused. But backers say those who came to the United States under the program were well vetted, with sponsors based in the U.S. For Robert, the job loss has been devastating for him and for family members who live with him and rely on his support.
My grandma, I have to take care of her too. I can't even take care of myself because I don't have a job. It's hard for me to pay a place to live.
And he misses a job that gave him a sense of purpose.
This month, the first court case began against a British soldier allegedly involved in a notorious political massacre in 1972. A march that year through the city of Derry in Northern Ireland was supposed to be peaceful. It was anything but.
The UK broadcaster Independent Television News captured what became known as Bloody Sunday. British paratroopers fired on the unarmed crowd of civilians, killing 13 people at the scene. Another man died later from his wounds. That day, more than 50 years ago, was one of the darkest of the Troubles, a decades-long period of violence between Irish Catholics and Protestants.
Don Mullen was a teenager when he attended that march. He would later write the book Eyewitness Bloody Sunday that documented what he and others saw. He spoke with me recently from Derry.
So it was my first civil rights march. I'd been given permission by my parents to take part in it. And largely because the civil rights organizers had, you know, spoken to the IRA and got an agreement that they would stay away. So we were all expecting this to be a pretty uneventful civil rights march. I suppose things went ugly about 10, 15 minutes before the paratroopers moved in, when they shot a 15-year-old boy, wounded him, and they also wounded an elderly man in his 60s. And I just remember making my way up towards Free Derry Corner to listen to the speeches, and had just passed the rubble barricade when I heard a commotion behind me. And when I looked, I saw hundreds of people streaming in my direction and also behind the Roswell Flats, which were to my right. And behind them, I could see British soldiers in armored vehicles, covered lorries, as well as some foot soldiers, again running towards us. But then suddenly the shooting began.
Well, you're in your late 60s now. You were 15 at the time. What are the strongest memories that have stuck with you?
Well, the strongest memory from that day was the sound of Michael Kelly as the bullet hit him. And it was like he'd been hit by Muhammad Ali, you know, in the stomach and had been winded. And I just remember, oh, and he fell to the ground. And there is a photograph taken by an amateur photographer, Robert White, and it captures me hunkering, looking in the direction of where the shot came from. And 2.5 feet to my left is Michael Kelly lying in a fetal position. And then there's a second photograph by Robert White where it appears I'm over young Michael Kelly to see if I can render assistance. And then I recall bullets hitting the rubble barricade, people falling. I remember there was 2 men pushed past me, and then they retreated because of the shooting, and then a bullet hit above my head, and I remember the wall bursting and bits of fragments of mortar and bricks, they came around us, and at which point I realized this is dangerous, I've got to get away, and I get up to run. I just remember someone shouting, get down, they're firing live ammunition. And after that, I have no memory whatsoever for about 3 minutes until I ascended steep steps onto a road called Beechwood Avenue, and a woman's voice brought me back And she said, "Son, what's happening?" And I said, "Mrs., there must be at least six people dead." I don't know why I said that.
Was Michael Kelly a friend of yours?
He was 2 years older than me. So as you can imagine, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old, it wouldn't be really an age group that would mix around. But what I remember about Michael Kelly was that he was the goalkeeper of Dunmore Gardens, which was two streets below mine, Leaning Gardens, and I was the goalkeeper of Leaning Gardens. So we sometimes played football against each other. In later years, I became great friends with his brother, John, who was a stalwart campaigner for justice for all of the families and the wounded of Bloody Sunday.
Don, just give us a little more context for people not familiar with this period in Northern Ireland. Why were there armed British soldiers there in the first place?
Well, Ireland was partitioned in 1922 and the statehood of Northern Ireland was set up, and it was created as an artificial majority Protestants over an artificial minority of Catholics. And there was a lot of gerrymandering, a denial of civil rights and human rights for Roman Catholics, discrimination in jobs, discrimination in housing and so on. So the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association began in 1967, inspired by the Black Civil Rights Movement in the United States, because people could see similarities in terms of how Black people were being treated in the United States to the way we were being treated. And the very first Civil Rights March in Derry, 5th of October 1968, was brutally attacked by the Royal Ulster Constabulary, who were the police force of Northern Ireland and the only police force in the United Kingdom to be armed. Then in 1969, there were a number of what we call orange parades, like marches through Derry and so on. And
right.
These marches were given police protection and were given the right to march, whereas our marches were being banned. So this created huge frustration and anger. And there was a fierce riot for 3 days. It was known as the Battle of the Bogside. And the people fought the police into exhaustion. And at a certain point, it was decided that the British government would commit British soldiers onto the streets of Ulster. I sometimes think that it was a last gasp kind of attempt by the Northern Ireland government to try and beat our community into submission through this massacre. But in fact, it had the opposite effect.
Mm. At the scene on that day, January 30th, 1972, a British colonel, Derek Wilford, told a journalist that the deaths were, quote, unfortunate, but his men were defending themselves, responding to gunmen. I want us to hear that.
Local people are saying that you used excessive force when you went in there.
Well, what is force? If you're being fired at, you return fire, and they know that perfectly well.
How many gunmen do you feel you've hit in the Bogside?
Well, I'm told from my Quixit rep, you must understand it's a very Quixit rep, that three gunmen were hit.
Decades later, Don, what do we know now about the reports of gunmen?
Well, in response to what Derek Wolford said, the British understood the power of the first soundbite. And immediately they said that they came under a fuselage of bombs and bullets that they fired back at targeted gunmen. They also said that some of those killed were actually on the army's wanted list, all of which were lies. And in fact, the night after Bloody Sunday, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Edward Heath, invited the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, the highest judicial figure in the United Kingdom, to meet him in 10 Downing Street and asked him if he would conduct a public inquiry because there was such an outcry. And within 6 weeks, Widgery conducted his inquiry, eyewitness statements, one of which was mine, he ignored. In the end, he found the innocent guilty and the guilty innocent. So paratroopers we had seen murdered, unarmed civilians, and Lord Widgery murdered the truth. So you've got to understand then that, again, another seismic moment when young people were looking at this and saying, we cooperated with this British inquiry and it was a whitewash. So there's no such thing as British justice. Therefore, we will fight fire with fire. And as a consequence, many young people were lining up to join the IRA. And for almost 25 years after it, Bloody Sunday became a rallying cry for armed republicanism in their fight against the British government. But I can tell you, there were no armed civilians amongst those who were shot and killed or wounded on that day.
So accounts from your book, Eyewitness Bloody Sunday, The Truth, they were included as evidence by the Irish government when it demanded a renewed inquiry into the Bloody Sunday massacre. So decades later, we're now seeing one of those soldiers on trial. Why has it taken all this time, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question because, I mean, again, you know, the power of the soundbite took us 25 years to catch up on it. The wheels of justice, they turn very slowly at times. And many of the families we very are done by in the sense that, you know, it's only one soldier and it's for two of the dead. But then, you know, many have said, well, you know, justice for one is justice for us all. And this particular guy was particularly vicious. I mean, some of the killings that, you know, I've documented and he carried out were just appalling. I mean, one that he's not been tried for in this is Barney McGuigan, who was 41-year-old father of a young family. Paddy Doherty was out dying. He was calling, please help me, please help me. And Barney eventually couldn't take it anymore. And he took out his handkerchief and he bent over and waved his handkerchief, showing he was a threat to no one. And this particular soldier who's been tried for two other murders, not for this one, but he knelt down and he took him in his sights and he fired and the bullet went through the back of Barney McGuigan under his left ear and came out over his right eye. And when Barney fell, like his body ran like a tap. And there's a lake of blood in the photographs around the right-hand side of Barney. I mean, just appalling. And this particular soldier, one of the deaths was Liam Ray. Liam Ray was already wounded and he was trying to raise himself up but couldn't because he was paralyzed by the first bullet. And eyewitnesses are very clear that as this soldier passed him, he went pew, and he shot him in the back. I mean, this was a wounded man whom he executed, so it's in violation of the Geneva Convention as well. So it's extraordinary how this was all covered up, and it was the families, the Bloody Sunday families. Yes, my work and other journalists' work played a very important role, but it was the families who never gave up in believing that one day we will have the innocence of our loved ones declared before the world, and they've achieved that. And now there's the possibility that one of the soldiers might at least be brought to justice finally.
It is a little confusing because this soldier, their identity has been shielded from the public. They're being referred to only as Soldier F. I mean, they were not the only soldier there that day. What do you make of that?
Listen, a lot of them have already died. I think even in terms of the difficulties in getting to this day, and this case still might collapse, we just don't know what kind of legal wizardry they might pull out. He's the only one that we got. We think that there are other ones who should have been brought forward. But, like, this is British justice, you know, so we take and we run with what we've got at the moment. And we also know the name of Soldier F, you know, because there was a radio operative who was with 1st Battalion Parachute Regiment on that occasion. And he wrote a document later in which he named all of the soldiers. And they weren't just responsible for Bloody Sunday. These guys carried out a massacre as well in Belfast. So this was a regiment that was out of control. But at least we've got at least one of the soldiers from Bloody Sunday before us. And let's see what happens.
I mean, it has been 53 years, so claims of not recalling things are plausible. And Soldier F is being tried in Belfast Crown Court in the UK and will be defended by the UK Defence Ministry. How confident are you that justice will be served?
I'm not confident, and hopefully we'll be surprised, like we were surprised when Prime Minister David Cameron stood up before the British Parliament and he said what happened on Bloody Sunday was unjustified and unjustifiable, and therefore, as a government, we have got to take responsibility, and I'm very, very sorry. I mean, people in Derry gasped. We never thought we'd hear a British Prime Minister apologising for the events of Bloody Sunday. So now there is this legal case, and let's hope we might be pleasantly surprised. I don't think he'll spend a lot of time in prison. But just from the point of view of the families and just from the point of view of justice, like someone who not only took the lives of innocent people, but through that act called Bloody Sunday, was responsible for many other innocent people dying as a result of it. It's very important that at least we see that the British are prepared to call one of their own to justice over this act. So we remain hopeful.
Don Mullen was 15 years old on Bloody Sunday in 1972. His book about those events is Eyewitness Bloody Sunday, the source for the feature film Bloody Sunday. The trial of Soldier F began this month.
New protections for the world's oceans. That's just ahead. You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The high seas have long been a place that sparks the imagination. Stories of sailors, pirates, and adventure. There's also a lot of economic activity happening far out at sea. Shipping, fishing, oil drilling, and in the future, potential mining for valuable minerals. Now, a new international agreement could mean more environmental protections for the open ocean. As of last week, more than 60 countries have ratified the High Seas Treaty. That is enough for it to take effect early next year. Heidi Weiskill is an expert on the world's oceans at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in Washington. She explains how this new agreement can help address problems that fell through the cracks of other agreements.
Honestly, there is so much that happens on the high seas that we are not aware of, and that we we may know that ships are passing through, but they go dark. We aren't able to trace where they're going or what they're doing. We're not tracing whether or not they're fishing. We're not understanding whether or not there are other activities, dumping of, bilge water into the ocean, dumping out trash. So there are activities that happen that should not be happening on the high seas. And the idea is that if we have this kind of collective global eyes on the high seas, it will reduce the number of harmful activities that are happening out there and allow us to better understand and therefore protect and respect the species and the habitats that are out there.
Huh, that's interesting. So even though there is this international law of the sea, there are activities happening that no regulatory body or national government knows about, like dumping, things like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And there are more and more studies coming out and some really good investigative reporting coming out around exactly that concern. The idea of sort of what is happening on the high seas is out of sight, out of mind. It's hard to get there. It's hard to, it takes days to get out there. We have satellites that take spot images and then they move on. So we don't always know all the things that are happening. So it's important that we have more eyes on. And that, I think will make everybody safer and it will protect the ocean more.
I understand you're a marine ecologist. What is happening in the water right now that you are particularly concerned about or see a lot of opportunity here for?
Yeah, I would answer that in a couple of different ways. I think, we're definitely focused on the fishing that happens that is unregulated and unreported. And we know that in some cases, the take of species that are not the target species of the fishery at levels that almost certainly are not sustainable. And so that is concerning, that certainly when you think about shark species, the number of shark species around the world, we're really concerned that those are plummeting precipitously. And I think on the other side, there's been a lot of focus on a lot of excitement around the idea of marine geoengineering being a solution for climate change. And I want to make sure
So doing things like adding minerals to the ocean so that it captures more carbon, something like that.
Adding nutrients, right, exactly. Yeah. Or changing the chemistry of the ocean, hoping that there will be an increased drawdown of carbon, exactly, as you said. So the idea is that we want to make sure that if those pilots are going forward or those ideas are moving forward, that there is no harm to marine biodiversity.
There is a provision in this agreement for the protection of genetic material. Can you tell me what that means and why genetic material in the deep sea needs to be protected?
Yes. So the marine genetic resources pillar of the treaty is really important because it allows an opportunity for increased research and understanding of all the potential benefits, these material benefits that could come out of the ocean. And so we don't fully understand all of the potential, sort of new compounds or new solutions for particular diseases. We're doing this in terrestrial systems as well. We have, frogs that end up with a particular kind of venom that ends up being beneficial for an anti-cancer treatment, for example, right? And so we know that we can be fairly certain that those kinds of compounds also exist in these deep sea marine genetic resources. So the idea behind this agreement is that we have this just and equitable approach to access to those compounds and those genetic resources.
So there's been a lot of negotiations going on around the idea of potentially mining the deep sea floor for metals and minerals. How would this agreement impact how and if that deep sea mining ends up happening?
Well, the agreement has the ability to look at all the activities that are happening in the deep sea. And so certainly seabed mining would be one of the ones. And, you know, the agreement works closely alongside the other authority, which is the International Seabed Authority. And so together, the two bodies essentially would be looking at any potential application for exploration or exploitation of the deep sea with regard to seabed minerals.
You know, the high seas are so far removed from most people's day-to-day life. I'm wondering if you can, you know, paint a picture of what it's like out there and why that matters to people who live maybe in the middle of a big country, very far from the ocean.
Absolutely. I mean, there are people who like to remind us that every second breath we take comes from the ocean. And that is certainly true. But it's also true that we're all connected in terms of our overall food security. And so much of our food does come from the ocean. And if you have seafood at all in your diet, then the health of the high seas is directly related to your own food security. And I would say, too, that, you know, there are activities happening out there. You know, you want to make sure that anything that's transiting through is going to make it safely. You want to make sure that there aren't people who are working on ships who can't get free or can't get back to the mainland, who are, you know, forced labor. There's a kind of obligation to care about what's happening out there because it does directly affect the food that we eat and the commodities that we consume, even if we're 100% landlocked.
Heidi Weiskill is with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in Washington. The new High Seas Treaty goes into effect in January.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.